I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd, tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the woman who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Enchenna, or The Fire, read by Mary herself. And here she is to tell us more about it.
This isn't a case that occurred under the Witchcraft Act. It's not a witch persecution in the way that we think of Scottish witch persecutions, because the Witchcraft Act was repealed in the 1730s. But Catriona Míchigenáin, Catriona nin Lachlan Víchigáil, died in Slate, in the south of Skye, in 1747, 12 days after she was attacked in a house in Camas Cross, which is a little township in Slate, a lovely wee place today. Catriona was, we think, begging around the house of one man, Ruairí Mac Éin. He was a MacDonald, and he was a taxman to MacDonald of Armadale, Clandonald in Slate. And a taxman was a sort of a land agent, essentially. The clan chief owned the land, but it was administered by taxmen in Gaelic as a fertachta, a tax a wee bit of land. And Ruairí Mac Éin found Catriona outside his house, and he accused her, it seems, of witchcraft and of attempting to poison him and his men. And what we understand he did was take her in, bind her hands and bind her feet, and then burn her feet over his fire, attempting to make her confess. Now, it's interesting because there is, generally speaking, a bit less witch persecution during the sort of classic period of the witch trials under the Witchcraft Act. There's a bit less in the Highlands. And of course, this is well after. So it's really interesting from the perspective of how superstition around witchcraft continued. And whatever went down, if you like, in the house, Catriona was able to get out, and she was found, I think, up the road at Duastill and died of her injuries. So she lingered for 12 days, which one can only imagine would have been a painful 12 days in that era. And I think it was an era, you think 1747, it's an era of enormous change in the Highlands. And one of the features of the witch trials, the witch panics, is that they do quite often pop up when there is other strife going on in society. There seems to be a very strong correlation between society having ills and woe, whether that be war or political change or famine. And suddenly that gives you the sort of hotbed where witchcraft allegations can kind of breed, if you like. I think in one of the stories I use the phrase, as fungus grows on rye, suspicion grows in the mind of men. So this is an era when, you know, traditional Gaelic society has really, you know, we've had the death knell, really. And a clan chief has ceased in some ways culturally to be the patriarch and has sort of rather more become a kind of almost an economic landlord. And perhaps the taxmen are becoming a bit less kind of pillars of the community, really key individuals, with this idea of the clan being one big family and is rather more motivated by profit. So, you know, that may be part of the reason. And I should say that this story was found by an archivist in Skye, Catherine McPhee. And she wrote about it. And a friend of mine sent me the link to a few articles. And I kind of thought that's a really fascinating opportunity to look at how it didn't just stop. And in other ways, we look at how the idea of the witch never went away. But this is, you know, someone actually being persecuted, actually being tortured. But it was, of course, criminal. And Ronnie MacGeoin was accused of her murder, although he wasn't convicted of it.
The fire a man makes for himself, in chinne in ní dinne ga hain. For Catherine MacKinnon, the chatrianna nich ginnagin. It has been a raw, hard, hungry day, and although it is still quite early, Morag has retreated to her bed, as it is the only place she will feel warm right through. She heard a story last week about the great hero Cuchulainn killing his own son by mistake, and her intention is to lie in the dark with her eyes closed and tell it to herself again. But the house is dark, the cat curls up beside her, and of course the inevitable happens, and she is sound asleep when Alan brings the old woman home. The first she is aware, the limp body is slumped beside her in the bed. She shakes her head, slow to wake and struggling to understand what's happening. Bhain a sin ag an dhichig, Alan's voice says. Hai ho fuad is a fain sin. She was lying in the midden. She's as cold as ice. Morag puts her hand to the body's cheek and almost snatches it back. The skin is as cold as that of any corpse. Alan has brought a dead woman home. But as they peer through the darkness, there is an awful noise from the body, halfway between a moan and a gasp. The sound breaks the spell that has bound Morag, and she clambers out of bed. Cuirfeon Flatjí, she says, put her under the covers. She helps Alan to cover the old woman, tells him to make up the fire and set water to boil. She lights the oil in the cruiskin and hangs it as close as she can to the bed so she can see. She takes the old woman's hands from under the covers and chafes them between her own, first one and then the other. She has some hurt or other around her wrists, where the skin is broken and bruised. Morag is careful to avoid those places as she rubs, up and down from the hands to the elbows, and then to and fro across the upper arms. Soon the fire is glowing, and the room begins to acquire a smoky warmth. When the water is boiled, Morag pours a bowl and waits until it is cool enough to bear. Then she dips a cloth in it and holds it to the old woman's skin, pressing in the warmth, dipping it back in the bowl as it cools, pouring in another ladle of hotter water again whenever the bowl itself begins to lose its heat. As she works, Alan slips outside, saying he has something he must fetch. Morag's intention is only to warm the woman, but as she works, she sees that her efforts are also cleaning away the glaur that cakes her. The poor rags that clothe her are sodden and filthy, and Morag strips them off as she goes. There is nothing she can do about the matted hair. She takes a clean shift of her own from the kist and lifts the old woman to dress her in it. She is as light as a child, as fragile as a bird. They are all thin this year, for the weather has not been kind. But this woman is little more than bone. Sminik, minik, minik, Morag whispers. He kries dirukka hogirich. Often, 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 Christ comes in the guise of a stranger.
think something that we were really struck by in this story, and we'll revisit in other stories as well, was although there was so much cruelty and darkness around the witch trials and thereafter, what really came across to us in this story was this sense of kindness in the community that you brought into the imagining how things were at the time. And that felt like an important thing to remember, because it can get very dark and heavy with these stories. But I think in our music, we really touched on that idea of that warmth. And we wanted to kind of recreate that idea of the warmth and the way that she was brought in by the community and how they pulled together despite having very little themselves.
I think it's important, that idea that, you know, we had, and, you know, I completely fictionalized what happened to her after the attack on her, because in a sense, and it may be important to say that while this is something that was primarily done to women, women were also very commonly the accusers. It's kind of natural in a way, because women's lives will bring them into contact in this kind of era more with other women than it will with a kind of broader society. And so if enmities have sprung up and people are accusing other people, it's going to be the people in their immediate circle. And for women, often that's going to be women in this time period and the earlier time period. And also, many women probably didn't have it in them to accuse men. So, you know, if they were going to accuse anyone, they were going to accuse other women. And so actually, I kind of wanted to think about, exactly as you say, there had to be people who weren't motivated by these petty cruelties, who would, of course, have taken in a stranger. And one of the things I used in the story was just a little Gaelic rhyme about hearing a lark say, sminik, 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 kriest ruch gachokiri. So often, often, often does Christ come in the guise of a stranger. It's that idea of, for often in that way they have entertained angels. And so it was also for me important to write about a community that had religious faith, but weren't using that as a stick to beat people. And I think also it was important to me personally, politically, small p politically, to have a Gaelic set story that wasn't all kind of wee free, if you like, kind of, you know, people very often characterise Highland religion as this very sort of strict, stern, and you know, refer to it rudely, I suppose, and with that wee free idea. You know, I liked the idea of kind of that big warmth.
Yeah, I think when we were approaching the music as well, having that warmth was definitely another angle to go down as well, because it's very hard, like you've touched on already, there's so much darkness, and it's very hard then when you try and transfer that into the music to not just continually go down the dark route. So having that feeling of warmth and a little bit of that kind of juxtaposition between the strength found in that community and the sorrow of the story as well, was, I think that track actually came together quite quickly.
Hanyel Grain Biak in Yvishin Guiv, Morag says to her, "We have no food to give you." The woman says nothing. Morag is not sure she can hear. In the morning, if she sees the morning, Morag will brew a stew of nettles to feed her, or of dulse. That will help sustain her, without giving her poor stomach too much too soon. She is clearly unaccustomed to meat or milk. At the thought of food, Morag's own belly gripes. Just then, Alan comes in with a bundle he sets on a stool and opens. There are oatcakes, a large piece of white cheese, a string of dried fish. "For Elisich," Alan says, "from Elizabeth." Morag's eyes fill with tears of relief. This is bounty indeed, supplemented with dulse and nettles, wild garlic and silverweed. This will keep them going until Alan can harvest the barley. It will keep them fed until the poultice Morag has made for the cow's udder has had a chance to work. Morag fervently hopes it will work. Alan's eyes turn to the old woman, and Morag sees that he is worried Elisich's bundle will not be enough to save them if they have an extra mouth to feed. Morag thinks this gift may have come for this very reason, God helping them extend hospitality to this poor soul for as long as she may need it. "Sminik, minik, minik," she says for the second time tonight. "Hig kriest uruch gachokiri."
There's a part in the story that really stood out for us, which is when Morag and Alan learn Katrina's name, and you say in the story it somehow felt easier to care for her now they know it. And that felt like it kind of summed up the whole project in a way, that idea of learning these people's names and imagining a life for them. And it contextualises something that's so big. It's so big that you can't really get a sense of how it actually feels. And so that idea of we know her name, it's easier to care about something when you know a little bit more about it and have that human connection.
I think that's right. And I also think that it's important in many circumstances where people are victims of something, that they may have been a victim of something, but they are still themselves. These are very much in the main stories of male violence against women. And so in that sense, you know, I was thinking about those kind of experiences that sadly persist into the modern era. And actually, yes, giving her her name, she's not just, and maybe there was a bit for me also in the politics of the fact she was a beggar woman. And of course, you know, as that society was starting to kind of come unstuck, the idea of, you know, her being on the road begging seems very wrong from, you know, thinking about Gaelic culture and hospitality and the idea of, you know, the clan system looking after its own. So actually the idea also of the way that we can demonise and dehumanise people who are experiencing homelessness or who have left their homes for, you know, the many reasons. Obviously, the example that's in probably many of our minds is when politicians reprehensibly began to talk about people, or commentators began to talk about people as though they were kind of less than human swarms of migrants and all that kind of thing. And I think that was all in my mind. I also wanted to pay tribute to the kindness that I've always experienced in Gaelic society. Just that basic human kindness and the concept of hospitality.
When they rise at dawn, the woman is alive and warm, but it is the warmth of fever, and her skin is damp and sweaty. Morag sends Alan to see if he can find elderflower and mint to brew, to bring the fever down. While he is gone, she redresses the feet, gingerly lifting the wet linen from the awful burns, wetting it once more and laying it back on. It seems kinder to do this while the woman is asleep. Morag will have to rouse her soon so she can drink. Even without fever, a body will surely die without water. When Alan returns with such leaves and flowers as he has found, they brew the drink and attempt to rouse the woman, raise her up and spoon it into her mouth. Her eyes never focus, but she takes in a little, and they lay her down again. She drifts back into sleep. Or perhaps she is unconscious. Alan is out with the rest of the township at the peats all day, and so Morag passes the long hours alone with the woman, going about her own work, stopping every now and then to spoon more liquid into her patient's mouth and moisten the dressings on her feet. The woman barely rouses, but Morag thinks her skin is cooler to the touch. In the late afternoon, though, she becomes agitated, crying and sobbing and repeating broken sentences over and over again. In the end, Morag climbs into bed with her, careful not to jostle her poor feet, and moulds herself to her side. The woman quietens and slips back into sleep. When Alan comes home in the evening, he has a dark look on his face. Morag knows better than to ask him straight out what is troubling him. She has learned through long experience that he will come to it in his own time. She has stewed nettles and garlic to eat with one of Elizabeth's oatcakes and a slice of the cheese, and as they chew, Alan tells her that there was much talk at the peats, disturbing chatter about Ruairi MacGeoin, MacDonald of Armadale's taxman at Camas Cross. He is known to be a difficult man, quick to take offence or raise a quarrel. More than once has a man in Slate left his company bruised, bloody, or slashed with a blade. Folk are saying that the taxman, deep in drink, accused a beggar woman of witchcraft. He found her outside his house and accused her of plotting against him and his men, planning to poison them. They say he hauled her into the house, bound her, and held her feet to the fire, demanding that she confess. She howled and screamed as they burned her, but denied any ill will against MacDonald, maintaining she only ever meant to ask for his help. MacDonald continued to torment her for a time until he became bored. His men, by then, had perhaps become uneasy. Someone untied the woman and dumped her by the road to Ailoransey. From there, she must have crawled to Dewster Big, where Alan found her. A couple of MacDonald's men have ridden off, they say, ashamed, perhaps, of what they were party to, or afraid of the consequences.
We've taken Heelan Harrow on the road a couple of times. We've done a couple of tours now. And our second tour in September 2022 was around Scotland. And we actually played in a lot of the areas where some of the stories were kind of based or nearby anyway. But this particular story felt really powerful, I think, for us. You know, a real kind of connection, I suppose, to the place. We went to Incrove on the Isle of Skye. I don't know if anyone's listening that's been to the venue. It's a stunning location and there's this beautiful view looking out from the art centre, and it actually is very close to Camas Cross where this took place. And both for us and I think for people in the audience, it felt like to go to a concert that's talking about these events that happened so long ago, but to be in that space where, especially in a rural community where it feels so close, I think it felt really powerful for us.
Yeah, it was very special, and also special that evening to meet Catherine McPhee, the archivist. She'd done all this work looking into Katrina's story, and then we'd taken inspiration from your interpretation of that. And to see it all coming together in that space that really is all about community, it's like Rachel, it just kind of sits on this bit of heather, but it serves the whole of the kind of south end of Skye as a real hub of the community. It's a special place, and yeah, probably an evening we're not going to forget anytime soon. And again, I think it just brings these stories and the witch trials and everything about it much more present in people's minds when they're sat there and they can say something like that actually happened out that window in that place that we live and work in day to day, go about our lives. That's all you can kind of hope to do when you create a project, isn't it? To not force anything down anybody's throats, but to make them go home and think about different scenarios and to think about their community and the effect that that might have had.
I think as a project too, it gives communities back their women, not in a way that is necessarily, of course, always a positive, but I also think it is useful because women's stories typically haven't been recorded. I mean, the stories of ordinary people generally aren't. It's generally, you know, political movers and shakers and those with power. And in a sense, the women are particularly missing. And we can, in uncovering some of the more difficult aspects of how we dealt with women in history in Scotland, you can also then reflect on why the women's stories are missing, because it's not just that they weren't recorded, it's that they were actively repressed. They were very much second-class citizens. And I found that actually too, going out and meeting people. I was in Lewis at Fachlin and two women came to speak to me afterwards and said they were going to Rodal to sort of pay tribute to one of the women that they didn't know. Well, they did know about her, but I think it just kind of gave them more and they just felt that that was what they wanted to do. And I just loved that. It inspired them to think about their foremothers. You know, it's a kind of pretentious word, but, you know, I just thought that was wonderful.
And like you say, it's just that little spark that makes somebody think about something. Rachel and I only embarked on this project because we had a chat about how little we knew about a period of our history that had such a devastating impact on so much of society, made such a mark. But for our entire schooling, we learned year after year about the Battle of Culloden and all these very male-dominated parts of our history. And I still to this day know very little about the women's side of that part of our Highland history. So it felt amazing to us that we knew so little about something that affected the whole country. We'll never know enough and we'll keep learning and keep having these conversations, which is so important. Yeah, it still fascinates us all the time.
And there are so many, there must be so many more stories out there to uncover. And I think lots of communities are doing that. You know, if you look like even in East Lothian, Jackie Crookston, who was involved in various, if you like, socialist action, anti-war protest, they've put up a statue. And that's something Scotland is so bad at. You know, the amazing fact that there are more statues of named animals in Edinburgh than there are of women. There's so much more to do. And I think the Survey of Scottish Witchcraft has pretty much got everything that we're going to ever get on the witch trials. But there's so much more of women's history and the history of ordinary Scots that can be reclaimed and retold and given back to communities so that they own it. And I think that's really important.
In Inchenna, we used some of the words from the story, just a couple of lines to turn into a little bit of a song. With hand and hearth, we took you in, we learned your name. We nursed you as our own, and with honey, we offered you peace. And I think that's something that I remember going back and forth with you, Lauren, about. And again, just having that idea of learning your name and that sense of community of bringing people in unquestioningly and just that almost intimacy, I suppose, that there is there. Just trying to capture that, I suppose. But we also used a little excerpt from this charm that we found in the Carmina Gadelica, which is a collection by Alexander Carmichael. He collected these sort of charms, incantations, and it's a really fascinating collection, really. And we've actually used this charm, translates as counteracting the evil eye. We've used a section of it in Inchenna, but we also use a section of it at the end of the album in Echler, which we can talk about another time. It translates as, if it be a man that has done thee harm, with evil eye, with evil wish, with evil passion, mayest thou cast off each ill, every malignity, every malice, every harassment, and mayest thou be well forever.
Asks Morag. What's her name? Did they say? Her name is Catriona Nichginigan, Catherine MacKinnon. It somehow seems easier to care for her now they know it. They call her by her name and her eyes open. They feed her some of the nettle stew, and although she can eat little, she tries, and she swallows more of the infused water than she has before. They speak to her now as they change the dressings on her feet, and while her pain is great, she turns her face to the wall and bears it. Morag is haunted by the story they have heard of Catherine's torment. She is afraid of the taxman of Camas Cross, who is a man of some power. Will he find out that Catherine is here? She is afraid that he might come to end the job he has started. What price will she and Alan pay for sheltering the evidence of the taxman's crime? Alan says he has said nothing to anyone about Catherine, but the neighbours know, for while no one comes into the house, Morag finds a steady stream of gifts on the doorstep. Fish, milk, herbs, honey, butter, even a large piece of meat. Morag's eyes are wet when she finds these offerings, for no one here has much at all to spare. The evil of their taxman fades a little against the kindness of the township. A week after she arrived, Catherine seems to rally a little, talking to them in a cracked voice and eating an oatcake and some cheese. But Morag is worried about her feet. She has applied the neighbour's honey to the burns morning and night, but the toes have blackened. As the second week progresses, Catherine sleeps more and more, and dark red streaks appear on her legs, leading upwards from her ankles. In desperation, Alan brings Elisich, who has some knowledge of healing. Elisich looks at the feet with pursed lips. She speaks a low word of prayer to Catherine and goes out for a long time. When she returns, she has a bag of leaves Morag does not know. A poinsin sanul, she says to Morag in a whisper. A jean or she in ye tulluch. The poison is in her blood. There is nothing you can do. She tells Morag how it will progress. She has seen such a death before. She says the leaves will help hasten the end, brewed strong in water. Sweeten it with honey, she counsels, and she will go peacefully to her eternal rest. On the 12th day, Morag knows the time has come. Catherine's pain is great, and Morag brews the leaves and cools the drink. Once Catherine has drunk it, Morag sits with her and holds her hand, wetting her lips now and then with water and honey. Gradually the rictus of agony leaves her face. Her heartbeat slows, and her breath rattles in her chest. She rears up a moment in panic, but Morag soothes her and helps her down. Catherine closes her eyes, and she is gone. That night, Alan and Morag make their decision. They will report the taxman for his crime, and then they will wait. If they must, then they will pack their gear and make their way from this place where they have lived and their ancestors have lived since time immemorial. They trust that as they encircled Catherine and cared for her, the Lord will guard them should their pursuit of justice cast them into a howling waste of wilderness.
You've been listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album, with thanks to Mary Kitt.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.